From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden holds a nearly two-hour press conference to defend his first year in office and celebrate his accomplishments, and Senate Democrats fail to pass their voting rights bill and to break the filibuster rule in the Senate. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal, joined here today by my colleagues Kyle Peterson and Kim Strassel. So President Biden's press conference, an epic event, as these things go. I can't remember a two-hour presser, but lots of issues to cover. And let's start out with a clip about whether he was governing too far to the left.
You guys have been trying to convince me that I am Bernie Sanders. I'm not. I like him, but I'm not Bernie Sanders. I'm not a socialist. I'm a mainstream Democrat, and I have been. And mainstream Democrats have overrun. If you notice, the 48 of the 50 Democrats supported me in the Senate on virtually everything I've asked.
All right. Well, Kim, is he not a Bernie Sanders Democrat? And what do you make of his assessment of his first year in office?
He might not be a self-declared socialist, but he's certainly been governing like one. And that is the source of his problem. You know, if you look out there, the press corps wanted to know, how do you explain the raging inflation, the raging COVID, the failure of your agenda? And Joe Biden had every kind of answer you could think of except the correct one. He wanted to blame it on the GOP for being obstructionist. He said the problems were simply so big, they're too tough to solve. He said that it was just that he wasn't messaging enough. The reality is the problem is the agenda, the ideas. They're not selling to the American public. They're not the answer to the problems of today. He might have had 48 senators standing with him, but the majority of the Senate, including Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, do not. And I think until this White House realizes what the real problem is, we could be in for a lot more long, rambling two-hour press conferences.
Well, the thing that struck me as the general theme was there was no real sense that he had made mistakes. I mean, he said at one point, yeah, I may have made mistakes, but he didn't really concede on any agenda points. There was no course correction. Striking, he's not going to change the staff at all. Ron Klain's job as chief of staff seems secure. If the only real concession, Kyle, that he made to what I would call political reality of the Senate was that he said, well, I'm going to break up parts of my Build Back Better plan and we'll try to pass them separately or in a reduced package. That's a recognition that he just doesn't have Joe Manchin on board to pass what he wants, and maybe not Kyrsten Sinema for some of it either. But he's not changing the agenda.
Right. No course correction at all. He said he did not overpromise the public about what he could achieve. He said he, in fact, outperformed. He had no apologies about Afghanistan. He blamed inflation again on the supply chain. He said he's satisfied with the government's COVID-19 response. And what makes this so remarkable to my mind is that his polling, his approval numbers are rather dismal. There was a Morning Consult survey this week. 68% of voters think that the country is on the wrong track. They asked voters to grade Biden's first year in office. 37% of them gave him an F. 12% gave him a D. That's almost half of the country right there. And despite this, he does not seem to want to change his course at all. It's interesting because you think about if you do a hypothetical where Republicans won at least one of those Georgia Senate seats, I think it's pretty safe to say that Biden's approval rating would be higher than it is today, and he would look like a more sure thing for re-election in 2024. And so why doesn't he govern like Republicans won one of those Senate seats?
Yeah, we editorialized at the time, Kyle, that we thought it would be better for Biden's presidency if Republicans retained the Senate, because then he would be obliged to try to govern in a bipartisan way. And he would be able to coax Mitch McConnell and some of the Republicans, or even if not the leader, then, you know, group of six or seven to come over to support some things. And instead, when they won those two Georgia Senate seats, there was this elation on the left that, aha, now our ship has come in, we can govern from the left. And I think he has done that in a way, and I think Kim agrees with this, that has now hit the wall. And the question is, what can he salvage here in the next year? He did take credit for the infrastructure bill. He did take credit for the American Rescue Plan. But when you look across the rest of the agenda, it has hit the wall.
Everything has hit the wall. Look at what also happened the same day of that press conference. You had Chuck Schumer, a mesmerizing decision to go to the floor for the sole purpose of humiliating two of his members, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, with a doomed vote on this voting takeover, which he then followed with a call to change the Senate rules on the filibuster. They had long signaled that they would not go along with it. It failed on the floor. So Democrats are no further ahead on that piece of agenda. What they have managed to do, though, is take that 50th and 51st vote, who they need for the president's agenda, no matter whether he's breaking it up into piecemeal or otherwise, they're still going to need those two people who they just humiliated on the floor. This is the only way you can possibly try to understand what Schumer's strategy is here, is that he's once again responding to progressive demands, the rage of wanting to put those two people on the spotlight, make them go on the record, isolate them from the party. How does that help Joe Biden in moving that agenda forward, whether it's in pieces or not?
I want to get to the Senate in a little more detail, but let's listen to, on the question of voting rights, let's listen to President Biden talk about the legitimacy of the 22 election.
Imagine if those attempts to say that the count was not legit. You have to recount it, and we're not going to count. We're going to discard the following votes. I mean, sure, I'm not saying it's going to be legit. It's the increase in the prospect of being illegitimate is in direct proportion to us not being able to get these reforms passed.
I think the only word for that is wow. I mean, here you have a president of the United States who ran explicitly as the anti-Trump, saying that the 2022 election might not be legitimate if people, some of the turnout isn't as high as he thinks it should be. And it sounded not unlike Donald Trump casting doubt in advance on the election, Kyle. Is that too strong a reaction on my part?
No, I don't think it is. And this morning, the press secretary, Jen Psaki, is trying to walk this back a little bit. She says in a tweet, let's be clear, POTUS was not casting doubt on the legitimacy of the 2022 election. And she goes on from there. But what makes Biden's comments, and maybe they weren't as well formulated in the middle of a press conference when he's fielding zingers from all sides, but this is the exact same thing he said in his speech in Georgia last week when he was saying things like, your vote won't matter. And I find it very disheartening that now, after all of the nonsense that has been said about the 2020 election, and a lot of it debunked, and still it's being spewed out about the 2020 election, now we have both sides, both parties, essentially telling voters that you can't trust American elections, despite the evidence to the contrary.
Very dispiriting to me too, Kim. Essentially, the leader of the Democratic Party now, and the president, and the leader of the Republican Party in exile, or so the press describes Donald Trump as that, basically casting doubt on voting, and it does not bode well for close elections and how we accept them in the future.
Right. Remember, this was the president, the current one we have, who said that he was going to restore standards and dignity to the office. And yet, here we go again. And this is unfortunately the new status quo for both parties, and in part because of their leaders. Instead of going out there and having a fight on ideas, or instead of accepting a loss and then doing an autopsy to see why you failed among the public and whether or not you need a course correction, instead both sides just say, well, we only lost because the other side cheated. And this only further discourages Americans from going out to vote. It discourages them from having any faith in their public institutions. And I think that that's why this is the most notable thing that Joe Biden has said in a very, very discouraging way, because it is so opposite to what he pledged to do when he was elected.
if Jen Psaki is being honest about walking this back, that's a good sign, the White House press secretary. And we'll have to listen to how Joe Biden approaches us in the future. We shall see. Now, we want to address another issue that came up in the presser that has created some problems, and that's the president's discussion about Ukraine and what would happen if Vladimir Putin invades.
Russia will be held accountable if it invades, and it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having a fight about what to do and not do, et cetera. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia.
I almost jumped out of my chair when I heard that phrase, minor incursion, and there would not be agreement on this among the Europeans, because the whole point of the U.S. policy has been aimed at deterrence, Kim, which is trying to say to Putin, look, if you do this, we will respond in such a way that we will do enormous damage to your interests, your economy. And instead, the president's suggesting here that, well, you know, if it's this, if it's just a little territory, or maybe if it's just shutting down their electrical grid or something that I don't know how you define minor incursion. He didn't either. But then the West will be divided. And that sends a message to Putin. Look, our deterrence is not what we say it is.
I did fall out of my chair, Paul. And I think a lot of people did, which is why the White House also tried to clean this up, walk that back a little bit, saying, obviously, we will not stand for Russia engaging in any sort of incursion, minor, major, whatever. But the problem, Paul, from my perspective, is that I don't buy that. I think Biden was speaking the truth when he said that. And more importantly, I doubt Putin buys that walk back either. He knows Biden was speaking the truth. And that's what's really scary, as you said. What we have at the moment, because everyone's made fairly clear, no one wants to go into an official war with Russia. So all we've got is deterrence and the threat of very strong retribution if anything happens. But instead, this week, we have that Biden comment. We also have a leak out of a German newspaper suggesting that Western governments have taken one of the toughest sanctions off the table, which would be removing Russia from the SWIFT banking system, essentially isolating it from the global economy. Now we're hearing, and Putin's hearing, that that might not be an option that is actually on the table anymore. So this has been a very bad week if the goal is to send the message to Russia that bad things will happen to it if it takes any move against Ukraine.
All right. Hold tight. We'll be right back with more on Joe Biden's press conference and the Senate votes. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. We're talking about Joe Biden's comments on Russia and Ukraine. And I wanted to elaborate just a little bit on this. The implications of this for Europe and Ukraine, his comments about a minor incursion maybe dividing Europe from the United States. And Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, tweeted on Thursday, quote, "We want to remind the great powers that there are no minor incursions and small nations, just as there are no minor casualties and little grief from the loss of loved ones. I say this as the president of a great power," end quote. Kyle, that was a direct riposte to President Biden.
And you can understand he has a right to be upset about this. I mean, I think Kim is right that this is an instance, to take the old definition of a gaffe, of a politician accidentally telling the truth. This is an instance of that. And to some extent, I think Putin already knows that. There's a range, a spectrum of options of things he can do, from cyber attacks on Ukraine to sending in these little green men and denying that they're Russian forces. But in the sense of trying to deter that, the Biden strategy should be solidarity and not showing the opponent your cards, saying that we stand with Ukraine and we are, you know, there are going to be repercussions for anything, that there's no such thing as a minor invasion. Any minor invasion will be dealt with swiftly and harshly as well.
It will depend, the consequences of this will depend upon how it's read in the Kremlin in particular. What does it mean? Does Putin, as you say, suggest to know that probably Biden was speaking the truth here and that the West will be divided in response and the sanctions not be as stiff and as punishing as Biden suggests when he says there will be significant consequences. All right, let's turn to the Senate vote, Kim. Chuck Schumer putting first up to vote this nationalization of voting laws and that going down to defeat. Did lack the votes to continue after amid Republican opposition. And then turning to a vote on to change the Senate rules so that they could pass something like voting rights and other things with a mere 50 votes, plus Vice President Kamala Harris is the president of the Senate breaking the tie. I need you to explain to me, Kim, and to listeners, why did Chuck Schumer do this when he knew it was certain to lose?
I wish I could, Paul, because it's unfathomable. This has been in the cards for months. Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin have made clear they would not break the filibuster. Normally, the smart move, always the smart move, if you are a leader, and this is something Nancy Pelosi has said publicly before, you don't bring to the floor any piece of legislation that you know is going to fail. Chuck Schumer did the opposite. Now, he claims the goal here was to put everybody on the record, to show how much support he had for this, to show that there were only a few holdouts. But I think of it in terms of the other consequences. He did, in fact, put everyone on the record. You had a guy like Senator Mark Kelly in Arizona, who for months has successfully dodged the question of whether or not he would break the filibuster, because it's a very risky position to have. But he was now forced to come out and join the caucus, probably out of fear of a primary. He's on the record. You know that Republicans are going to beat him over the head with it in that upcoming election. He's up for re-election. The same with Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire. The same with Catherine Cortez Masto in Colorado. This is, he's put them in a very, very difficult spot. And he's also made this issue of breaking the filibuster a top issue in the upcoming midterm election, and one that I don't necessarily think works in Democrats' favors.
Walking the plank, indeed. He's got these Democrats now who are running this year on the record as saying they want to change the Senate rules unilaterally to make it essentially like the House of Representatives, where a majority rules. And the implications of that legislatively would be enormous. For example, the Democratic agenda to expand the number of states in the United States by including the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. That is something that a lot of Democrats want to do and could probably pass with a mere 51 votes. You've got maybe packing the Supreme Court would be too far, but who knows? That could be also on the agenda. So there's a lot of implications here, Kyle. And now you have basically the Senate majority, 48 votes, declaring that if they get 50 plus one with a VP, they're going to do it.
Yeah, and Mitch McConnell has argued that even though this failed, this is a corrosive act trying to do this. It's corrosive to the institution. And part of that, I think, is it makes it more likely that the next Democratic Senate, if they have, if they pick up some seats, if they get 53 senators, that they will blow up the filibuster. I also think it makes it more likely that if Republicans in 2024 take back control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, that there will be enormous pressure on Mitch McConnell to do it then. And the argument will be, look, 48 Democratic senators just voted to do away with the filibuster, so they're going to do it next time. Let's make a preemptive strike, as it were. And the result of this could be huge swings in policy. And this is the argument that Kyrsten Sinema has made all along, that what you don't want is swings back and forth. If Republicans want policy to be set at 1 and Democrats want it to be set at 100, I get that it's frustrating to be fighting in the mid-range, in the middle of the field there, from the 55-yard line to the, you know, the 60-yard line in either side. But the alternative is all the way one way for 4 years or all the way the other way for 4 years.
Yeah, Kim, what about the implications for the Democratic caucus? We've seen Bernie Sanders say that he'd be happy to have Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema primaried when they're next up for election, which I think is 2024. And I think Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, was given a chance to say, no, we won't do that. And he refused to say if he would support them in that kind of a primary. And so, you know, they're basically declaring that these two votes, which gave them their majority, by the way, are persona non grata in some fundamental sense in the party.
The old rule in Washington is that if the headlines are all about your party fighting amongst itself, you are losing. And that certainly is the case here. I mean, the thing that's a biggest head scratcher to me is, as you said, Joe Manchin is their 51st vote. It's what gives them the majority. You go primary him in West Virginia. Bring it on. And let's say you actually even beat him in a primary. No progressive is going to win in the state of West Virginia. You've just lost that seat. This is not the way you build your majority, by isolating your members, humiliating them on the floor. And just one other side note of that, elections aside, you know, on the very day the president declares in a press conference that his new strategy is to break up his big agenda, Build Back Better, and pass it in pieces, you still need Joe Manchin to do that. And yet, on that very day, you hold a vote designed to isolate him from the party, annoy him. All your colleagues come out and say they'd love for you to lose your job. How willing is that going to make him to want to continue helping this president get his agenda across the line?
Do you think, Kyle, that there will be some ramifications here in the degree of cooperation from Manchin? Because the president did say that he hopes to be able to pass at least a big chunk of Build Back Better.
Yeah, it's hard not to think that that would play into Manchin's thinking to some degree, though I think that he has no lack of reasons to hit the pause button here. One thing he's been talking about for a long time is inflation. We got the latest inflation numbers for December, and they were up compared to November. Who knows what the figures this year will look like. But if Manchin wants to say, we're not going to pass any more trillion-dollar entitlements right now, maybe this is one reason, but I think he has plenty of others in his back pocket.
Well, we'll see how this plays out with whether Chuck Schumer's calculations work out for the party. I want to thank Kim and Kyle, and thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. The Potomac Watch podcast is now available 5 days a week, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.